From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on this morning's forum program, Iran is preparing to elect a new leader to replace Mahmoud Ahmadinejad on Friday. Turkey's violent protests show a growing rift between secular and Islamic influences, and meanwhile, a Syrian helicopter has attacked a Lebanese town, and Syrian rebels have reportedly killed 60 Shiites. We'll discuss the latest news from the Middle East and what role the United States might play with a panel of experts. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Protests continue in Turkey with four dead and some 5,000 injured or having sought treatment for tear gas as escalation against plans to bulldoze and redevelop a park in Istanbul and anger at Prime Minister Erdogan continue. Across the border from Turkey in Syria, the sectarian civil war rages on into the third year with hundreds of thousands dead, horrendous massacres, and an ongoing refugee crisis. And in Iran, where the government has put itself behind the Hafez al-Assad regime in Syria, a national election is slated for tomorrow. In this morning's opening forum hour, we're going to take stock of recent and ongoing events in these three nations with both separately and together play so central a role on the world stage, and we have a trio of experts with us for this hour's discussion. I want to first welcome back Janine Zakaria. She is a visiting lecturer at Stanford. She's also former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post, and glad to have you with us again. Thanks, Michael. Thank you for being with us. We also have Aaron David Miller back with us, Vice President for New Initiatives and Distinguished Scholar with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He has advised Republican and Democratic Secretaries of State, and welcome back, Aaron David Miller.
Appreciate always, Michael, the opportunity.
Appreciate your having us here. We're also going to be connecting with Mahmoud Manjapuri, who is Associate Professor of International Relations at San Francisco State and visiting Associate Professor at UC Berkeley, where he's teaching Middle East politics. Let me begin. We want to cover a lot here because even though we've been talking about the pivot on forum and the move toward concentration into the Pacific that the Obama administration has been talking a great deal about, the Middle East remains a region that is quite volatile, and these three nations are under our, both microscope and telescope this evening, this morning, what time it is. Janine Zakaria, let me begin with you. Let's talk about Turkey first. And it's not Tahrir Square in Taksim Square, but it has continued to escalate. And at first it was all about the park. Then there was talk about a referendum. Now it seems to be about Erdogan, who, despite the fact that there's a good deal of talk about his being an autocrat, is terribly popular in Turkey still, isn't he?
Well, he's popular, I'd say, among at least 50% of the people. But he's been a divisive figure for most of the decade that he's been in power. And the increasingly religious tenor that he brings through his politically, through changes that he implements. I think just recently he banned advertising of alcohol. He said publicly that women should have three kids. He's moving aggressively to reform the constitution to concentrate power in the presidency, which he hopes to run for next year. All of these things have alienated the traditional secular Kemalists, as they're known in Turkey, and really made him a divisive figure. So while the protests against this new mall in the park are the proximate cause of the protests, really it's more, I think, people growing tired with his heavy-handedness.
Well, you mentioned, for example, things that he's done as a religious Muslim, which he has openly said he is, including blocking the ban on headscarves at public universities. The airlines are 49% government-owned. He put a ban on lipstick and nail polish for flight attendants. I mean, this sort of thing. You go to Istanbul and you see how westernized it is in many ways, and you know, trying to get into the EU and so forth. So this is creating a greater schism within the country, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and look, Turkey is positioned geographically between the West and the Arab Muslim world, and they sort of bridge this gap, right? They are in between, and they're both, right? And then, of course, when you go to Istanbul, you see that secular side, but as you know, rest of the country, you've got pockets of religious support. And Erdogan's quite popular, and he's also quite popular among a coterie of businessmen who he's granted great contracts to, and he's got their support as well. And I think Turkey's the 17th strongest economy in the world. I mean, Taksim is not Tahrir Square; it's a completely different animal. These people are not looking to overthrow the government in Turkey. They're looking for less heavy-handed rule. And unfortunately, the kind of remarks we've just seen coming out of Prime Minister Erdogan, giving the protesters one last chance to get out, might forebode something terrible happening later today. But we'll have to wait and see.
He's also been calling them Marxists and terrorists and extremists. Right. I mean, the language has been pretty...
Conspiracy theories are something he enjoys.
And also using the terrorism laws to target journalists. And there's been excessive police force. I mean, Aaron David Miller, things in Turkey, particularly for a NATO ally and for a country that, as Janine Zakaria said, has such economic clout, the United States is deeply concerned about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think Turkey is an example, along with Indonesia, of a modernizing Muslim state. In fact, the only two Muslim countries in the world that really have created, you might argue, however flawed and imperfect, the institutions of a democratic transition. Whether Turkey can be described as a fully functioned democracy with a high-handed authoritarian leader, who I think has overplayed his hand both abroad and at home, is another matter. But I think it really is, Janine is 100% right, it's important to point out that this is not, the Turkish Spring is not the Arab Spring, and Turkey is not Egypt.
But there is this sense of concern about maybe things moving a little more toward the Islamic right in Turkey. It's a secular country with a secular tradition.
Well, I think that's the concerns of the secularists and many Western elites who believe that in trying to moderate the Kemalist legacy, the Erdogan is attempting to recast it completely and create a sort of neo-Ottoman legacy. After all, the demonstrations at Gezi Park were in part a response to not only giving up green space, but an effort to replace green space with a neo-Ottoman barrack-like mall and structure. So there is that sensitivity. But look, Egypt is a dysfunctional state. Its institutions are not functioning. It's dubious, frankly, given the way the Muslim Brotherhood, Morsi, has handled this transition, whether or not its institutions will ever be perceived to be properly legitimate. In Turkey, you have a fully functioning country with a strong, not only a strong, a vibrant secular tradition. And I doubt, even though Erdogan is reported to have constructed almost 17,000 new mosques, that's a lot. It really does want to consolidate his own power and an Islamist caste. It's arguable whether or not he could ever succeed. And I don't think he will. If, and this is the contingency, if you have protests that turn violent, and instead of a handful of people killed, which are too many, you have hundreds killed, and if this affects the driving engine of Erdogan's legitimacy and success, the economy, then I think you can see a situation develop where in fact you would in fact have a genuine, sustained political crisis.
Let me bring Mahmoud Manchapuri into this. He again is associate professor of international relations at San Francisco State, currently visiting associate professor at UC Berkeley, where he's teaching a course on Middle East politics. He's Iranian and was last in Iran back in 2005, and we'll talk with him about Iran. But first, let me get your take on Turkey, if I could. I mean, in terms of Middle East politics, all these Syrian refugees are moving into Turkey. There's been serious problem on the border with at least what appear to be operatives of Hafez al-Assad. How much do you see, just in terms of the volatility there, increasing? They may not have anything to do with the escalation of protests, but the volatility seems to be there nonetheless.
Yes, I agree. But before answering this question, I would like to express my agreement with Professor Zakaria and Dr. Miller. Absolutely, they are correct. And it seems to me that the situation in Turkey is not class-based conflict, but rather it seems to me it appears to be a cultural war here. And it's more than the park and what's going on with the park and construction of the mall and so on and so forth. It has to do basically with the clash of the secular and religious identities, which is coming to a head. And there's no way that Erdogan can get around that, despite the fact that he has been very authoritarian in his approach. To the point of Turkey's vulnerability with regard to the refugee situation in regard to the Syria, it seems to me that Turkey is really looking for a political solution and is not ready for a military solution because is afraid of not, being pushed to the point to have the ownership of the crisis in the aftermath of the Assad, downfall. I mean, they do not want to own this crisis in Syria That's why they're very, very careful about not pushing for a military solution, but rather for coming down very heavily on the side of finding a political solution.
Yeah, but they're arming the rebels. I mean, they're militarily giving arms to the rebels.
The money from arming the rebels and also the weapons and so on and so forth predominantly is coming from Qatar and Saudi Arabia. And they've really found themselves in a very precarious situation of not having a sort of zero problem with their neighbors. The foreign policy is now faced with this major challenge of zero problem with their the neighbors. And they're increasingly pushed in the direction of being dragged into this military conflict. But they try to avoid that because they do not see any solution. And they're very worried about the partition of Syria after the Assad.
Well, Professor Monshibori, if I could, I mentioned that I wanted to talk with you and the others about Iran. And let me just shift gears and go to Iran now. Things have changed in the Syrian conflict because of Hezbollah, and Iran is backing certainly Assad. But let's just talk about what's going on in this election, which is going to be taking place tomorrow. And it seems from all practical purposes that it's a farce. That, in other words, things are being run by the mullahs and particularly by Ali Khamenei, and everybody has to be vetted. Rafsanjani is no longer in. Do we have any kind of serious things at stake here in terms of Iran's future?
Well, I agree totally with you. This election is going to be among the lowest, is going to see the lowest turnout since the Iranian political system shifting from premiership to presidential. This is going to be the lowest turnout. That's why the other day the Supreme Leader came out and encouraged people to go, despite the fact that they may have disagreements with the regime, but he encouraged them actually to go out and cast vote, because this is really one of the most meaningless elections that I have seen in the past 20 or something years in Iran. Most of the candidates actually avoided the major issue in their earlier debates, the major issue being the underlying tensions caused by sanctions. But in the
from what I'm reading, the major issue is the economy, which is linking to the sanctions, the consequences of the sanctions, right?
Yes, and then, of course, economy is directly linked to foreign policy, because Iranians are under this draconian sanctions, and that has really crippled the economy, with inflation rate hovering at around 32%, unemployment rate around 18%, and the value of the currency, Iranian currency, which is called rial, has plunged by 80% within the past 2 years. So, the situation is so bad that even in the last round of debates, the six candidates started specifically addressing the issue of foreign policy, the issues of dealing with the West, and the necessity of dealing with the Western world. And so, there are two views, basically, Michael, with regard to what's going to happen on Friday. One is that the one view says that, the deck has already been stacked in favor of Saeed Jalili, who is the favorite of the regime, and, the deck has been stacked even before elections begin tomorrow. The other view is that there might be a fair competition between Velayati, who represents the right wing of the regime, and Rouhani, who represents the reformist wing of this competition. That if that is the case, if after Friday, maybe the results on Saturday and Sunday will convince us we are going to get to the second round, then at the second round, we're going to see the Supreme Leader pushing for his candidate, which is Velayati, and marginalize the importance of Rouhani. But the thing that is going to work in favor of Velayati might be the lower turnout that we will be witnessing. And so, yes, in some sense, this is, fundamentally speaking, this is a farce and setup type of engineers. Iranians use the word engineers.
Well, I'm engineers also thinking of the fact, in fact, Janine Zakaria and I were talking a little bit before we went on the air about how vetted this whole process has been by the Revolutionary Guard and by Ali Khamenei. I mean, to some extent, all these candidates have to pass muster. They're all in favor of moving ahead with the nuclear program. Some are a little more conservative than others, but for the most part, Janine, don't we have candidates who are essentially entirely with the regime.
Right. I mean, the supreme leader, he's already limited the race to those that he finds palatable, right? So he's already stacked the deck in a way. But, I mean, there are two things to point out in terms of what the professor was saying. I mean, domestically, it could have more of an impact, right, in terms of the economy and what these people bring to the table. And there's one area, I mean, very limited in terms of foreign policy. At a moment, though, to bring us back just brief, we're going to talk about Syria soon, where Iran is the key player in what's happening in Syria. And so you've got them doing this election thing right now, and then they are the ones we need to really be dealing with in some way if we're ever going to get to that crisis and be able to resolve it in some sustainable way. And I'd love to hear what Aaron has to say about that. But the one person who might miss President Ahmadinejad once he goes, as my friend Karim Sajapour in Washington at Carnegie Endowment wrote, is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, because of the kind of rhetoric that he had towards Israel, Holocaust revisionism. All this led to Iran's greater isolation, more sanctions, a European oil embargo last year, which has contributed to their economic difficulties. So if you have perhaps this more moderate, quote-unquote, Rouhani win somehow, and he's not making those kinds of tones, will the international consensus about Iran's nuclear program remain intact? That's one way that this election may have an impact, I'd say, foreign policy-wise.
But boy, you think about the last election and the Green Revolution and Mousavi and
I think he's still under house arrest, if I'm not mistaken.
Both he and Karoubi are still under house arrest. Mohamed Khatami isn't even running, you know, who is at least thought to be kind of the more moderate possibility in this. Let me go to you again, Aaron David Miller, on this. I mean, is there a way to let's make the connection to Syria. Is there a way to perhaps move toward doing something to resolve what seems to be an impossible situation in Syria for the United States, if perhaps there's a more moderate voice out of Iran than Ahmadinejad?
I think actually quite the contrary. I mean, I guess I would offer two observations. Number one, what's important about this election is what's not happening. I mean, the entire context of 2009, the Green Revolution, violence, dramatic and heroic confrontations in the streets of Tehran, all that is gone. And it seems to me that the regime, however weak it is, however constrained it is as a consequence of sanctions, has demonstrated that it, in fact, has a certain amount of legitimacy, even though legitimacy is driven by authoritarian control and repression. And I think if you marry that to the reality that Iran's stock abroad, at least with respect to how events are going in Syria, you have, to some degree, a renewed self-confidence. At the same time, you've got a regional war. And in the context of a war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which essentially this is, joined with the United States, in my judgment, will be drawn slowly, incrementally, into a greater role here. At a time when Iran is playing this role in support of Syria, married to Hezbollah, any moderate voice in this, regardless of who's elected, is going to be very constrained by the regional tenor, which is not a tenor of accommodation and negotiation at all, at least right now. It's a tenor of confrontation. And I think that does play to the advantage of the supreme leader. Let's not forget, though, that the role of the presidency in Iran has been important. The supreme leader was president. Rafsanjani was president. Khatami was president. And Ahmadinejad, who was written off as a sort of clownish, buffoonish figure, ended up, in a way, being the only semi-credible challenge to Khamenei's authority. So I'm somewhere in the middle here. Let's see what the turnout is. The turnout will, in fact, be determinative. If a lot of folks come out, and I can't imagine they will, it will further legitimize the system.
Well, do you think, let me just follow up with a question to you, Aaron, on this, that, as you describe it, a conflict between the Saudis and the Iranians, the Russians are also involved in this in a heavy way. And at least at this point, even though there's been talk about a red line, and Secretary Kerry has said that we're aiding the rebels but not militarily, the United States may indeed move into this also. I mean, we have some possibility here for a real Cold War again, heating up, and heating up in some very disturbing ways, do we not?
I think you have the possibility of a proxy war, which could clearly intensify and accelerate. I mean, on my own analysis is that, and Bill Clinton's remarks the other day to John McCain, in which he was critical. Now, remember who's talking here. The most popular Democratic president since Franklin Roosevelt, is criticizing the incumbent, in part because Bill Clinton knows only too well the regrets he had over Rwanda, and in some respects the success he had when he didn't intervene, late of course, in Bosnia. So I think that Barack Obama, by the time this is done, even though he wants to stay out, truly wants to stay out, and most Americans would back him, do back him, will find himself increasingly compelled to escalate the American role militarily. It may start with arming the rebels covertly, but I think it may actually, since there is nothing to stop it, Michael, see, this is the issue. Geneva 2.0 is dubious at best. And you have a military stalemate, if not successes by the regime. So nothing is going to get in the way of a situation that is going to continue to hemorrhage radicalism, fragmentation, violence, death, and destruction. And because there's nothing in the way of that process, I bet you it's only a matter of time.
And we also have the ongoing battles which have increased between the Shia and the Sunnis. And let me go to back to Professor Mahmoud Manshipari on this. I mean, I think Dexter Filkins it was who said, then what? I mean, as far as Syria is concerned. And I think, Professor, you would also say the real question here is, if Assad should fall, and this may just drag on and on and on, but if he should fall, that is the real question, isn't it? What's to follow?
Of course, because the problem is that there is no alternative to him right now. And there are, within the opposition, it appears that the extremist element outnumber the moderate element within the opposition that is fighting the rebel group that is fighting the Assad regime. And so we are faced with a very, very difficult problem of not knowing exactly what the consequences of our actions are going to be in the day after that Assad is supposedly deposed. And so there is this danger of, massacre. And there was this story in the New York Times today about the Alatla village in the eastern part of Syria in which 60 or something Shiites were killed. These are the harbingers of things to come when the Assad regime is eventually sort of deposed. And what really fears me the most is this notion of you have 10% of the population being Christians and then close to 10 to 12% of them Alawites, and then you have Druze, and then you have some, of course, military people or economic elites that have actually cast their lot with the Assad regime. There is going to be a very, very intensive sectarian tension that is going to really break the back of this regime, and could at some points I can expect that to lead to kind of partition, and that could then have serious consequences, far-reaching consequences.
All right, we're coming up on a break, and I have to invite listeners, pleasure to invite listeners to join this conversation. Please feel free to put in your own thoughts about this, any comments you might have or any questions you might have. We're talking about Iran preparing to elect a new leader to replace Ahmadinejad on Friday, Turkey, violent protests with a growing rift between secular and Islamic influences, and Syrian helicopters, we said, attacking a Lebanese town, and Syrian rebels reportedly killing 60 Shiites. You can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or email forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing the latest in the Middle East with a trio of experts and talking about the role that the United States might play. I was just talking with Janine Zakaria off air about the fact that there are cross-border attacks now, rockets into Lebanon. Hezbollah, of course, is involved. And so this is unfortunately spreading and continues to be exacerbated in so many different ways. There was, in fact, a Syrian helicopter that fired on Lebanese civilians over the border, and as we've said, Russia, the United States, doesn't quite know what role to play in this, and it's maddening. Janine Zakaria is with us in studio. She's visiting lecturer at Stanford, and also a former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. Aaron David Miller with us by phone, vice president for new initiatives and distinguished scholar with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Mahmoud Manchipori, who's associate professor of international relations at San Francisco State, currently visiting associate professor at UC Berkeley. We want to bring you into the conversation, and again, our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways of involving yourself in this program. With any questions or comments, you can email us, forum@kqed.org. You can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or you can go to our Facebook page or to our website. The website is kqed.org/forum. Let me go to our callers, and we begin with Joel. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for the professor who was talking earlier about Iran's domestic economic policy. And wouldn't the people of Iran be better off economically if Iran spent its currency not on arming extremists in Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, and preparing for what was referred to earlier, tension with Saudi Arabia, if it spent its currency on helping its people?
That may be a bit of a rhetorical question, Joel, but... Well, let me get some response from Professor Manchipori, since you directed it to him.
Yes, of course. I mean, Iranians would be better off if they turn inward as opposed to outward. But the Islamic Republic apparently has a foreign policy of based on not only pragmatic foreign policy, but also ideological orientations of promoting its revolution, supporting its Shiite brothers in Lebanon, and having an affair with Hamas. This is part of the foreign policy. Is it a correct foreign policy? Of course it has not been. It has, Iran is the most isolated country in the Middle East right now, and both strategically, economically, has been isolated. So the foreign policy of Iran has been a major disaster. That's why it became, towards the end of the debate among the six candidates, foreign policy became a very important issue, and almost all of the candidates, they said unanimously that we have to improve our relationship with the Western world because foreign policy is actually destroying our domestic politics. And so the caller was absolutely correct, but that's part of the Islamic Republic foreign policy, and I'm not sure that with any of these candidates, we're going to have a drastic change in foreign policy in Iran. Possibly some kind of changes, modifications here or there, but it remains to be seen that Iran will actually make any sort of drastic foreign policy change. I doubt it seriously.
I think it's also safe to say, Janine Zakaria, is it not, that Ali Khamenei and the present revolutionary theocracy in Iran wants to play a major, almost even Persian hegemonic role in the Middle East, in the same way that Erdogan in Turkey would like to maybe establish some kind of caliphate and also take a major role in the Middle East?
I mean, even before you had the revolutions begin, in the Arab revolutions they are, in the beginning of 2011, everybody was talking about this, Turkey and Iran being the major powers now. Saudi Arabia and Egypt were already kind of over. And what you're seeing, I think, is Iran, whatever its problems internally, having enormous success abroad in a way that Turkey is not. I mean, Turkey was really trying to frame itself as the new leader in the region. They don't want to get involved in Syria. They're not doing anything. They're taking a lot of carnage on their side of the border. And Iran is having enormous success in continuing to arm Hezbollah, in propping up Assad. I mean, without Iran and the Russians, I mean, Assad probably would be in a much weaker state. So I think that it's true that the foreign policy has been largely a disaster, but I think that they perceive, correct me if I'm wrong, that they see themselves as in fact winning regionally and being among the more powerful states in terms of influence.
And do you want to weigh in here, Aaron David Miller?
I'm sorry, I missed that, Michael.
I just was going to ask you to weigh in here in terms of Iran trying to establish itself in the Middle East as a major power, and also, to some extent, under Erdogan, Turkey trying to establish itself the same way.
I mean, I've argued elsewhere that the real story these days is not the rise of the Arabs. In fact, what you're witnessing is, in some respects, the decentralization and weakening of the Arab state structure created during the period 1970 to the present. In many respects, and I mean this quite seriously, the three most consequential countries in this region today are all non-Arab. You've just identified two of them: Iran, Turkey, and I would add the third, obviously, Israel. These are three countries which have the capacity to project military force abroad. They are relatively coherent and cohesive at home. They have tremendous potential, even though Iran is under great constraint right now and Turkey is under a certain amount of political crisis, to also project economic power abroad. And I think a chief among them in this regard, although Turkey's aspirations to regain a unique position in the Arab world, which was abandoned to some degree under Atatürk, Mustafa Kemal, is Iran, driven in large part, in my judgment, by a profound sense of insecurity on one hand, but on a profound sense of entitlement on the other. The Iranians believe they are a truly great power, destined for greatness in their region, with tremendous amount of influence, not regional hegemony. There is no single power in this region today, or outside of the region, frankly, that can impose its will. That's actually, you might argue, is part of the problem, that it's a lack of organization and cohesion, not too much, that confronts the Middle East right now. But no, I think Iran in its own region, in Lebanon, in Iraq, and yes, in Syria and in the Gulf, strives to be the preeminent power.
I'm looking at an email here, Aaron David Miller, from a listener who says, so my main question is whether there is any single group in Syria that the U.S. wants to win. The rebels seem to be affiliated with Sunni extremists, al-Qaeda, and the other side is the Syrian regime and Hezbollah. Who should we support? It's not exactly a very welcoming kind of choice. In fact, it really puts the president, doesn't it, Aaron, in almost virtually an impossible position.
It really does, in part, Michael, because we're emerging from the two longest and among the most profitless wars in American history, Iraq and Afghanistan, where the standard for victory was never, and we see this very clearly now, some saw it in 2003, standard for victory was never could we win, but when could we leave? And extrication, the act of leaving, is frankly not the right metric, or the one you want for judging the most behavior, the most consequential power on earth. So the president understands this. And the real analogy for Iraq and Afghanistan is really, I've written about this, is not boots on the ground. Nobody is talking about the deployment of thousands, let alone hundreds of thousands of American forces in Syria. The real thing worth paying attention to is the relationship between how military power, American military power, can be used or not used, I might argue, to affect the end state. That's the real problem, and that's the one the president, I deem him the great extricator, his job is to get America out of unpopular wars, not get them into new ones. That's the real dilemma that he faces right now. And final point, I do, however, think he is being dragged to do more on the military side.
A couple of other listener remarks on Turkey before I go to more of your phone calls. This listener says, as a Turkish-American scholar who returned from Istanbul last week, I characterize the violence propagated by the government and police as one of the most atrocious in recent years. The government is doing everything to discredit, deface, and undermine the legitimate protest, propagating all sorts of lies and totally controlling domestic media. Stories and photos can be seen on Facebook, Twitter, and many websites, but not on TV or newspapers from Turkey. And Paul says, what is not clear to this listener is just what are the objectives and policies of these various countries that lead to a stable, peaceful region? Turkey is getting sucked into the vortex after a century of bona fide Islamic democracy. Seems to be all agitation, no enunciation of the future state of affairs. The cynic in me says that will continue to be the case. There are centuries of history to back up my cynicism. Let me go to more of your calls. And we go to Tariq. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm actually had just returned from Turkey about a few days ago, having worked there at a medical school for the last year or so, and working closely with the Turkish Medical Association as well as the Ministry of Health. And I actually wanted to mention that the situation is far graver than what is seen from outside. I was actually appalled by how this is really portrayed. This is really not a few demonstrators in one city. There were more than 100 demonstrations in one day during the last 12 days alone.
Forgive me, there was actually protests in 67 of the 87 provinces, or 81 provinces.
there are more than one cities in each province.
Yeah.
So there are actually and one of the things that I think has become really the ammo of the current government is really to provoke violence. There are actually documented photographs of the civilian police in civilian clothes going to Tucson Square, throwing Molotov cocktails, despite all the warnings from the protesters for not use violence. And the next day, the police used that excuse to literally, injure hundreds of people. I also wanted to say Professor Miller was very gentle and kind enough when talking about democracy in Turkey. Currently, I cannot talk about a democracy in Turkey. People have been jailed for their thoughts. There's a famous pianist, Basil Sai, who performed the New York Symphony, who actually was jailed for sentenced for 10 months in prison for tweeting a sentence from somebody else, for retweeting. I have 19 of my colleagues who are physicians who are actually currently in jail for tweeting what is happening in Turkey during these protests. So I think there really is no means to suggest that Turkey is doing this, handling this properly. I also wanted to warn something coming up by the government. There is a second initiative that actually the current government, Erdogan, has begun, which will probably start in the next few weeks, about a sweeping operation to prosecute, persecute, arrest, and jail every single individual who played a major role in current protests. And this is going to be a very, very serious issue, and things are going to get far worse than they are currently now, that before they get any better.
Tariq, I want to thank you for your call, and thank you for that assessment and that warning or caveat that you ended with. And Janine Zakaria, we're talking really about an autocracy now, are we not?
Well, I mean, it's democracy in the sense that they've had free and fair elections. But what really it means is the real test of whether it's going to be able to continue to be a democracy beyond the trappings of democracy, elections and so forth, is how the leader, in this case Erdogan, is going to be able to tolerate dissent. I mean, that's the real key question there. I mean, he's obviously acting in an enormously autocratic way. I remember when I was reporting there for the Washington Post in 2010, I had to meet people in secret locations, you know, military officers, journalists. They were worried about their phones being bugged. People were scared even then. So it's clearly gotten a lot worse, and it's a very important call that we just had. So, I mean, I think the jury's out on this. The problem for the West is that Erdogan and Turkey have been the poster boy of moderate Islam, of what we've been striving for in the Arab countries that have gone through their most tumultuous period in recent memory. So, and that the poster is tattered, right? I mean,
when the Arab Spring took place, everybody was saying Egypt can be like Turkey.
Egypt could be like Turkey. Exactly. I don't think we want Egypt to be like Turkey.
Well, we're going to go to another caller, and that's Al Salam. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I've been hearing about the UN report how both parties are war criminals, basically killing innocent civilians. And at the same time, the opposition is being supported by Al-Qaeda and all that. So why would the U.S. help the opposition? And second, wouldn't it be like thrown a fuel into already burning flame? That would be my question.
All right. Professor Monshibari, let me go to you on this. Again, the alternatives for the United States here are not good.
So why would the U.S. help the opposition? And second, wouldn't it be like thrown a fuel into already burning flame? That'll be my question.
Right. Okay, I think we've got the question. I don't know what happened to that caller, but there really are no good sides for the United States here. Although, do we have you on, Professor Monshibari?
Yes, I heard the first part of the question having to do with Al-Qaeda, but I didn't hear the second.
No, it wasn't coming through clearly, but I think what he was just simply asking was, what's the advantage for the United States either way? Because there seems to be a leaning, at least to some degree, in providing assistance to the opposition or to the rebels in Syria.
Yes, I think you have one of the opposition elements is Al-Nusra Front.
Yes,
Jabhat al-Nusra, Nusra Jabhat, which is clearly affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and it's supported among the opposition, is supported by all elements within the organization. This really adds a layer of complexity to the American foreign policy, which is kind of tempted to support the opposition, but at the same time is not quite sure about the nature of this opposition. Who are these people? Who are the opposition, and what kind of help the United States is going to offer them.
The problem, is because we did a program on this, it's the opposition seems to be very fractured. I mean, you certainly have those Sunni extremists, but you also have those who are, well, reformers and more moderate.
Yes, and so you do have a confluence of elements that they are not united, and they're all kind of ideological polarization among them, which makes it very difficult to form a cohesive, group of opposition force there. And so the one of the interesting things that doesn't really get reported in the Western media more generally, but in American media more specifically, is that the Alawites, who are the offshoots of the Shiism, they do not actually believe in, they're not strictly, by Shia, but even by Shia and Shia the standards, they're not strictly Muslim, because they don't actually, the Alawite women do not cover their hair with hair scarf, and the Alawite men and women don't typically go to mosque, and a very, very liberal type of the offshoots of the Shiism. And so, it is like looking at this situation and thinking that, am I going to overthrow this regime and then replace that with the elements that are very extremist? And so it really has created a sort of a ethical conundrum above the strategic complexity of the situation, has created an ethical dilemma for the United States.
I want to bring another caller on. And Dorothea, thank you for waiting. Join us on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm really enjoying your show. I wanted to point out that your guests seem to be ignoring the role of Saudi Arabia and United States alliance with the Saudis, and that the United States probably will not allow the Saudis to be threatened by having a larger Shiite presence in the Middle East or strength in the Middle East. I really think that oil needs to be talked about here, because underlying all of this is the control of oil. And again, the U.S. is the biggest ally of the Saudis, and no one ever talks about the Saudis. So I'd like to hear more about that from your guests. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad you brought that up. Aaron David Miller, oil in the Saudis?
I mean, look, the paradox is that as the Arab Spring turns into a more forbidding winter, the paradox is that the United States is going to continue to rely on those nations in this region that have weathered the Arab Spring with minimum dissent and dysfunction. And they are, in the main, the kings. Jordan, it may be an exception here, but I think even in Jordan, the king is not faced with an overthrow. The pressures will be more evolutionary. But in Morocco, in Saudi Arabia, in the Gulf, the U.S. will seek continuity, rightly or wrongly, for its policies by a heavier reliance on Saudi Arabia. Number two, as the confrontation with Iran heats up, if it does, in 2014, getting the Saudis to support American policies are going to be extremely important. As for oil, the good news here, if there is any in this broken, angry, dysfunctional region, is that the United States is in fact reducing its dependence on Arab hydrocarbons, not on hydrocarbons. I mean, we're going to be dependent on oil for the next 50 years, even with the proper conservation standards better fuel emission standards and green technology.
So there's a lot of oil coming from Venezuela, Mexico, Russia. Is there
exactly the large? The Canadians and the Mexicans now are the two largest sources of imported oil. That my point is that we still, even if we reduced our dependence on oil, would still have to worry about energy security, because the Europeans, and as Japan weans itself off of nuclear power, the Europeans and the Japanese will become continually dependent. And the reality is we cannot afford to, see an area through which flows 40% of the Earth's known petroleum reserves tied up by hostile powers. And it does introduce, Michael, a certain anomaly and contradiction, even hypocrisy in our foreign policy. We support an Arab Spring in Egypt. We will not support an Arab Spring in Saudi Arabia.
Again, if you would like to join us in the time remaining, you can do that at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, or right on our website. Any questions or comments you may have, and That is kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. I'm going to go to some of your website comments. Here's a listener who says, where is the realist, an objective analyst, a critic of empire, just anyone to throw cold water on the flag-waving American exceptionalists who wittingly or not pave the way and promote a new war? That's what frames this discussion. Bad, bad Iran, and how can we innocent good guys deal with such irrational wrongdoers? I'd like to get all opinions in here. Another listener writes on our website, please distinguish for me the Occupy protests in the United States from the Turkey protests and the government reaction as well. Well, there have been a lot of analogies made along those lines, Janine.
Well, it did remind me a little bit of New York City, I guess, but I just can't see it. It's just very hard to compare. I know people think Michael Bloomberg was a little heavy-handed with the soda, but it's very hard to compare him to Prime Minister Erdogan.
And a listener says, would love to hear your guests discuss big picture, long-term solutions to issues in the Middle East as a whole. What's our goal and how do we get there? Education, jobs, dialogue, women's rights. Professor Monshipuri, can I have you weigh in on that?
Well, it's very difficult to actually talk about all of these problems in Middle East to be resolved in the foreseeable future. I think the Middle East is going to have a number of issues. First, demographic issues. You have a youth population that is educated but unemployed, and you have a situation of the economic difficulties that the region is suffering from, the global crisis, which is still having its impact in the region. I think Middle East is going to be preoccupied for a number of years with its internal problems, and now add to this, to these problems, add the sectarian tensions in the region between Shia and Sunnis that has its repercussions in both Iraq and Syria. I do not see that, any foreign power outside of the Middle East can really pursue a consistent and long-term policy vis-a-vis the region, because the problems are very, very diverse and very difficult. And are a pile of problems that cannot be addressed and overcome.
Yeah, I think each country, it's safe to say, has distinct and sui generis problems from in the three countries we're talking about today. But when you look at just economically the differences, I mean, I still think the centerpiece in this Iran election, though it may have a low turnout, probably will have a low turnout, is going to be economics. And economics seems to be rather strong where Turkey is concerned, but now in jeopardy. And Syria is a case unto itself. There's really nothing, in fact, Aaron Derby Miller has written about this, there's nothing that can even parallel or be analogous to what has occurred in Syria. Let me get another caller on. I believe it's UC Berkeley Professor Jihan. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for the show, and thanks for the coverage of Turkey and Iran. I just wanted to say that even though most of the Western press has been covering the clashes in Turkey as a cultural divide, this is really far from the minds of the protesters. And you can see this if you look at their declarations and demands. All of the demands are about democracy and urban rights and stopping the construction of the mall and stopping this crazy urban renewal throughout Turkey. And it is true that the government has been portraying it as such, and the main opposition party also wants to turn this into a cultural war with the government. But the protesters have little sympathy with the main opposition party, and they see this mostly as a way to protect nature and cultural legacy and historical legacy against a mostly business-driven and undemocratic authoritarian urban renewal.
But when the Prime Minister Erdogan said that he would meet with protesters or talked about a referendum, there was a great deal of balking at that by many of the groups out there, and they're fractured probably, who said he needs to resign. I mean, in other words, it would appear that they want him, many of them, removed from office.
Resignation is a demand that you can hear on the streets, throughout the streets in Turkey, but when it comes to the main square and the park and its demands and its declarations, and all of this are all of these are written in Turkish and these are accessible, and the mainstream media has been ignoring them, there is no demand of resignation.
Has there been demands for have you seen demands for a new election or for a more forthcoming election, more imminent?
This is not the demand of the protesters, no, because this is about really protecting basic urban rights. And what the government wants to do is to put these basic urban rights to referendum. And it was the prime minister who said in 2009 that basic rights cannot be put to vote. And these are the basic rights that the protesters are defending.
All right. I thank you much for that.
Aaron David Miller, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yes, I think the caller is absolutely correct.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Professor Monchipuri. Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, I think Prime Minister Erdogan is in some ways is trying to transform not only culturally but also socially. He wants to transform Turkey, and the resistance is coming. So I think the caller is absolutely correct. The resistance is coming from the urban areas that are seeing that some degree of, capitalism, entrepreneurship is actually changing the site, the urban, sites and archaeological sort of sites and all the things. So the resistance is there. But I think the part that caller misses, and that is conspicuously lacking in his argument, is that we have seen a very authoritarian style of leadership that is not going to leave a little bit of a space for compromise and tolerance for diversity. And so that really has added a new dimension. It's Prime Minister Erdogan actually bragged about, if there are this many demonstrators or protesters in Taksim Square, I can bring a million of my supporters. So he bragged about his supporters and all these things.
Professor, we're going to have to leave it there. We've come to the end of the hour, but let me extend my thanks to you and to Aaron David Miller and to Janine Zakaria for spending the hour with us. We started with Turkey. We're going to conclude there. I want to thank all of you for being a part of this morning's program. We are coming up, of course, on another hour of Forum, and want to thank also those who are behind the scenes here. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Howard Gelman on the controls today, senior editor Dan Zoll, and executive producer Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.